This is Dori Smith with Regime Change Radio, a half-hour program on the importance of voting to bring about regime change in America. Journalist David Miller joins us today to talk about a new book he has edited, Tell Me Lies, Propaganda and Media Distortion in the Attack on Iraq. Speaking to Danny Schechter of MediaChannel.org earlier this month, David Miller said, quote, "We can expect more disinformation and misinformation next year, with renewed efforts by the U.S. government to leapfrog over any semblance of critical media with news feeds that bypass the news networks and are fed directly to local stations. Media control will intensify as perceived bad news threatens to disturb the domestic tranquility that the administration is hell-bent on preserving. This is part of the privatization of and a synergization with a strategy adapted by the U.S. military called information dominance." And that was quoting David Miller. According to AP reporter Jason Kaiser, writing from Tikrit, Iraq, the high-tech U.S. battle gear aimed at insurgents in Iraq includes computer screens on Humvees that carry information from military commanders directly to the field. His story, appearing in the Hartford Courant January 2, 2004, states that the new computer technology allows commanders to give orders to their soldiers in the field through screens in Humvees and with assistance from aerial drones and global positioning satellites. It's a new kind of high-tech war, but to David Miller, it is also further evidence of the new ability governments have to control information both into and out of war zones.
One of the key things in terms of the use of technology in relation to questions of propaganda is the concept of interoperability, which means that there's a concern with making sure that all information systems across the military operate together, talk to each other, whether that be computer systems used by, say, the Marines versus the Air Force, or whether that be the kind of technology you're talking about that is being used in Iraq just now, where there are computer links between soldiers on the ground and their commanding officers, and they use their superiority, their dominance in information control to be able to keep populations under surveillance and to target populations, including engaging people in armed action, whether they be civilians or the resistance. And that kind of technology is a key part of what they call information dominance. And I think one of the interesting things, little-known things about it, which is what I've been trying to point out, is that concept of information dominance doesn't just refer to interoperability between computer systems. It refers to interoperability between different sorts of information, both internal to the military, but also external, in the sense of media relations, in the sense of propaganda, in the sense of psychological operations. And the military now see no difference between the kind of thing that they're doing on the ground with downloading technology and the manipulation of the media and actually the attacking of independent journalists.
David Miller is the author of a January 8, 2004 piece in The Guardian, Information Dominance. He's joining us to talk about his book, Tell Me Lies, Propaganda and Media Distortion in the Attack on Iraq. Welcome to Regime Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I understand that in the UK there is an awful lot going on about this so-called surreal war that you describe, the war that was going on in the upper echelons of power versus the war on the ground that our UK and US soldiers saw in places like Iraq. Tell us a little bit about where you feel the public is in all of this discussion in both the UK and the US as we hear now that we were lied to, and it's not a question anymore, it's a fact.
Public opinion is an interesting question. I think it's fairly clear that all around the world, with the exception of Israel and the US, that majorities of the population were opposed to the war back in February 2003. You know, really, really very large majorities, even in countries like the UK. And there are sizable minorities in countries like the US against the war. Public opinion did kind of change as the war started. Media coverage in the UK, for example, stopped featuring any dissent. It had monitored and marginalised dissent before the war started, but after the shock and awe campaign started, dissent was more or less removed from television, especially, and that meant that some people in the UK, for example, started to go along with the war and thought, well, once it started, we need to try and get it over with as soon as possible. But in the period after what was called the liberation of Baghdad, people have become more and more sceptical again of the war. And to the current day, for example, we have polls in the British press this morning suggesting that large majorities of the population think that the inquiry we've just had into the death of a weapons inspector was a whitewash, that the government has lied about this prospectus for war, and that the government is much less trusted by the population than, for example, the BBC is. Only 10% of the population are willing to say that they trust the government more than the BBC.
Now, your book was officially launched last night at a big to-do, and I understand things went very, very well for you. It looks like your book is going to be quite a success. Yet it's coming out. Now, today it's January 30th. We're looking at stories about BBC apologies, and I'm questioning now. This is a Glenn Frankel item from the Washington Post that in London, members of the BBC are humbled and apologizing to Tony Blair. How do you understand that? How do you put that in context to your theories about the media?
Well, we've had this inquiry from the judge, Lord Hutton. And I should tell your listeners a couple of facts about Lord Hutton. Lord Hutton cut his legal teeth, as it were, defending the British Army in the Widgery Tribunal in Derry in Northern Ireland in 1972, where 14 innocent civilians were gunned down by the army. And that inquiry went down in British legal history as one of the biggest whitewashes in the post-1945 period. And I think it's becoming very clear here now in the last day or so since this report came out that he learned an awful lot from Widgery, and this is an attempt to do, as we say over here, to do a Widgery on the facts around the death of Dr. David Kelly. So it's become very, very apparent to the bulk of the population here that this is a whitewash from a judge who is extremely conservative and by no means independent. But having said that, the whitewash is so thoroughgoing and so condemnatory of the BBC and excuses almost everything that the government has done that this is causing a backlash amongst the public and amongst the BBC. Now, that's some kind of context for what's happening with the BBC. The BBC governors, that's the ruling body of the BBC, have apologised, have grovelled before the government, have even apologised for things which were reported on the BBC which were true, and that's led to a great rift within the BBC, so that the Director General has gone, and yesterday we saw across the UK 17 separate BBC offices of staff walked out in protest about this. Now, there's real concern inside the BBC. This is about the government really trying to remove the political independence of the BBC. And I should emphasise that political independence is already fairly limited. Historically, it's been fairly limited. And over the last 20 years, as broadcasting has become commercialised, it's become even more limited. But this really is a crucial moment for the BBC and for the existence of free media in the UK. And we'll see over the next few days how the issue develops, but it could go very, very badly wrong for freedom of speech and free media here. But on the other hand, the more positive note of this is that the staff are clearly very, very angry, and there will be demonstrations across the UK tomorrow in support of media freedom outside BBC offices up and down the country. So I think that we need to see the apology in that kind of context, that there is a deep division within the BBC now over this, and that there is an emerging unity, which would have been thought unthinkable during the war, an emerging unity between the anti-war movement here, which is very big and active, and many of the mainstream journalists in the BBC, because we're now on the same side.
We're talking with David Miller. He is the editor of a book, Tell Me Lies. It's just out, Propaganda and Media Distortion in the Attack on Iraq. That book is available from Pluto Press. You can log on to www.plutobooks.com to pick it up, and you will find in it contributors John Pilger, David Crouch, Des Friedman. Name some others and tell me about this book and how it came together for you.
Well, it's also got chapters by Noam Chomsky, by Edward Herman, Norman Solomon, by the folks from PR Watch in the US, together with Yvonne Ridley, the journalist who was captured by the Taliban back in 2001, and lots of other key reporters such as Robert Fisk. How did it come about? It came about, I was saying this last night at the launch, at a meeting in the National Union of Journalists headquarters in London on the 9th of April 2003, which was at the very moment that the statue of Saddam Hussein was being pulled down in Ferdowsi Square in Baghdad. We were meeting together to discuss how we could combat the torrent of lies which were being told about what was happening in Iraq, not just in relation to the run-up to the war, the false perspectives, the notion that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that the Iraqi government posed any threat, that there was a link between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, which again was false, but also in relation to the coverage of the war, where it seemed that any amount of propaganda from the US and the UK would be repeated unchallenged on the mainstream broadcast networks. Just to run through quickly the stories from the first week of the attack, the fall of Qusar 9 times, the fall of Basra several times, the discovery of chemical weapons factories which didn't exist, the surrender of whole companies of the Iraqi military which hadn't happened, etc., etc. And so it came out of a real concern that propaganda was going unchecked and that many mainstream media outlets in the UK as well as the US were not properly discussing and criticising the information which was turning out to be false. So it came out of that, and it came out of trying to correct the record, set the record straight. And so what we've done in the book is we have sections on the propaganda apparatus of the UK and the US, the global propaganda apparatus, and then there are sections on the mainstream media reporting, and then towards the end, sections on what can be done about it, about alternatives to the mainstream media, or how the mainstream media can be changed and democratized.
Now, it's an election season in the U.S. We've heard an awful lot about the Iraq war, but it seems the focus is shifting or being shifted now away from the war in Iraq. And it's made to seem that the American public is more interested in the economy and other aspects, health care. These are vitally important issues to Americans. However, they don't undo the fact that we have soldiers abroad, as do people in the U.K., that are in harm's way every day. And the thousands of Iraqi deaths going on, and the numbers there growing to exceed perhaps even 50,000, we don't know yet.
Mm-hmm.
So in sum, we have a situation that no one could say is not an international emergency. And yet in America, during an election year, we're being deflected away from it. Is this something that you could see from where you are as information dominance?
I think to some extent. I think information dominance is perhaps a wider concept than just being able to divert attention onto other issues. I mean, obviously the election is going to take a lot of attention, and the extent to which the Democratic candidates will raise the war and continue to raise the war will be something we see as the weeks go on. But I think information dominance is a much more worrying concept than just being able to manipulate the media successfully. It requires that all information is friendly information, that it suits the purposes of the U.S. And its foreign policy and military planners, and that if it doesn't suit the purposes, then if it's regarded as unfriendly, if it's sufficient to make a difference to U.S. foreign policy, then the solution is, and I'm quoting Pentagon documents here, to deny, degrade, or destroy unfriendly information. So I think that the whole question about diverting attention is a valid question, but really a much smaller question than the kind of global ambitions of the U.S. of U.S. foreign policy. But in a way, I think there's an interesting point here about the U.S. and about the movement in the U.S. against the war, which is that yes, they will try and divert attention. Yes, they will try and put it behind them, like Blair is doing here, like Condoleezza Rice is doing in the States at the moment. But the most interesting thing about information dominance and the campaign to try and put Iraq behind them, to draw a line under it, is the way in which they're finding it difficult. They have to have concepts like information dominance, and they have to spend millions of dollars. In the case of the U.S., the Office of Public Diplomacy has a budget in excess of $1 billion every year propaganda operations. They have to spend this amount of money because there is so much opposition and because the opposition is becoming more successful. And that's the other side of the rather frightening propaganda apparatus. They fear us. They fear the movement against war and the movement against inequality. And that's a message of hope, I think. So I think, well, while we can criticise the moving away from concerns about the war and talk about it in terms of diverting attention, we must also remember that they are scared of the movement against the war, and actually the movement against inequality in terms of domestic policy, whether it's to do with prisons or with healthcare or with transport or anything else.
In America, the questions about the media have gotten pretty intense with Michael Powell, Colin Powell's son, involved with the FCC. Mm. And one of the questions people have had is, how far is this going to go to the break point where Americans finally get to say something about the media and the control of the media by the Pentagon, the White House, etc.? How far will things have to go before we find a way to address this, both legally and also in terms of our Constitution here? And then in the case of the UK, you are up against the House of Lords, the government, and a whole information apparatus there too.
Well, I don't think it's a question of how far we'll have to go. I mean, it could go very, very far. Noam Chomsky puts it as usual very well in his new book, that it's about a choice between resistance to American power or barbarism. And it could go very far. It could become very, very nasty. We could move, you know, towards something similar to fascism. And the only alternative to that is resistance. So it's a question of the history being unwritten. And while that is always the case, the future is unwritten. The current period is a period where there's more hope now, I think, of change than there has been for 30-odd years. And I think we can see that with the emergence of not just the anti-war movement globally, but the anti-globalization movement as well. So I think it could go a lot further and it could get a lot worse. And that's what we have to be wary of.
In one of your pieces, Big and Little Lies on Iraq, you say, for the sake of clarity, let us say a few words about lies to combat the accusation of erecting a mirror image propaganda from the margins. Lies are falsehoods, you say, the status of which the liar is aware. This is becoming a campaign question now in America. Not just did the CIA give the White House bad information on Iraq, but did George Bush know it was false information?
Yes. And it's the key question, and this is the question which Blair and Campbell in the UK are desperately trying to rule out. They're saying you can have serious debates about whether we should have gone to war and about whether the information on Iraq is correct or not, but you cannot and should not question our integrity. And they're trying to stop broadcasters and the media in general questioning their integrity. But of course, it's the only question left about weapons of mass destruction. It's not a question of whether they exist or not. It's a question of whether they knew that they didn't exist before they went into the war. And I would say, well, a couple of things about that. Both in the US and the UK, it's clear that elements of the security and intelligence services and the CIA and MI6 were very worried about this charade and tried to stop it happening. And so there were divisions in both of the intelligence agencies, which resulted in leaks to the press in both the US and the UK. So one should be careful saying it was just the intelligence services. And the second thing one says is, of course, that the Bush White House created the Office of Special Plans specifically so they could find evidence which they could put before the public to justify the war in Iraq. And the third thing one would say is that if you look at the evidence which they put out in Colin Powell's address to the UN, in the famous dossier in the UK, the plagiarised one, which is stolen from somebody's thesis, and the other one with the 45-minute claim in it. It's not a question of them getting the information wrong unwittingly, and we know that because of the evidence which is actually in the dossier. And the dossier itself says that the Iraqis could launch within 45 minutes some chemical and biological agents using ballistic missiles, and they use the term ballistic missiles in the dossier. And that claim includes three separate falsehoods, that there were chemical and biological agents left. According to the UN reports, they were largely sludge by 1994, useless sludge, as Scott Ritter puts it. There were no ballistic missiles of that range left in Iraq, as the UN has confirmed. And the 45-minute claim applied only, as we find out in the Hutton inquiry here, the 45-minute claim applied only to battlefield munitions, i.e. ones that could fire a few hundred yards. So it required the melding together of three separate falsehoods to get to the 45-minute claim that Iraq was a threat. Now, how do we know that Downing Street knew that those were false? Well, we know because the evidence they give in the dossier for there being any weapons of mass destruction, of chemical and biological agents, the evidence they quote are the UN reports from the weapons inspectors. But when one examines the weapons inspectors' reports, one finds that they say precisely the opposite of what the government has said that they have said. So we know that they lied because their own evidence contradicts the case that they're making. Now, unless we're arguing that they mistakenly left out the word not in a monumental feat of incompetence, which I suppose isn't beyond the realms of possibility, then we have them on the construction of a lie which involved three separate deceptions at least. And this is only the tip of the iceberg in relation to the deceptions of that particular dossier. It's been calculated that there are 36 separate falsehoods in that particular dossier. So, I mean, it is important that we're clear that lies are falsehoods which are known to be false by the people who put them out when they put them out. And it's clear that what happened in relation to the case for war was known to be false by them when they put it out at the time, because they had the evidence which showed that.
You know, in Reuters, again, today, January 29th, is a story about Condoleezza Rice and this hot political issue created now by former Chief Weapons Inspector David Kaye, who has resigned. And what's happening here is that this is a concise piece by Adam Entus. He talks about the fact that the White House acknowledged that it had been a mistake to accuse Iraq of the African uranium purchase attempt. He also quotes Condoleezza Rice, and I want to ask you about this quote as a journalist. Rice says, quote, "I think that what we have is evidence that there are differences between what we knew and what we found on the ground." Tell me about your response to that as a reporter. Is that enough to say that she is admitting that the intelligence and the statements she made and the White House made were wrong?
Of course she's not admitting it. She's saying we knew it. Now we don't know it. It's like the famous Donald Rumsfeld quote, isn't it, about known knowns and unknown knowns and unknown unknowns and that kind of thing. I mean, they play with words all the way through. If you look back to 2001, before 9/11, there's footage of Condoleezza Rice saying that Iraq poses no threat. We've closed down all the weapons. We've isolated them. His army is broken, and he is no threat. And you know that clip is simply never played in the mainstream media. So they believed, including Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, who again is a clip of him saying the same thing. They believed in 2001 that there was no possibility of going into Iraq, and they were saying that there was no threat. And it's quite clear that what 9/11 gave them was the excuse to start to say we need to go into Iraq, and they've manufactured the evidence is simply and only in order to do that. That's what the Office of Special Plans was for, you know, because the CIA wouldn't cooperate. So I think they are trying to squirm and to get off the hook, and they're doing it, I think, more effectively in the US, where they're admitting that they might have been wrong slightly more openly than they are over here, where Blair still seems to be saying that that they were quite correct to say that they were weapons of mass destruction, when everybody knows, from David Kaye to Hans Blix to Scott Ritter, anybody who's looked at the evidence, that there weren't any weapons there, and they knew that at the time.
Now, you said that at your celebration of the launching of this book, that there was some discussion about what can be done to stop this process of disinformation from the top down. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the movement against war has to be built, certainly. But it seems to me that in the UK and possibly also in the US, although I don't have quite such a feel for what's happening precisely now with the Kaye stuff and the Condoleezza Rice stuff, but they have done their own inquiries. And in the case of the UK, there's been three separate inquiries, all of which have been whitewashes because they've been done by officials and by appointed judges and by the establishment. And it strikes me, this is one of the things we were talking about last night at the launch, and which actually other people in the movement have been talking about in the last few days, it turns out, that if they won't tell us the truth, then we need to find out the truth ourselves. And we can't do that by saying, calling on the government to have another independent inquiry, because it won't be independent, because we cannot trust them. Nobody trusts them in the public in the UK or the US. So it strikes me that the thing to do, and this is a genuine live suggestion, the thing to do is to have an international popular tribunal on the case for war and the intelligence evidence for war, on the lines of the Russell Tribunal into Vietnam back in the early 70s. And I think that that's the kind of thing which could bring together all the evidence which now exists in reports which the mainstream media are ignoring, from David Kaye's reports to Hans Blix's reports to the retired brigadier who did a big report on US propaganda, to the report done on the Niger fabrication of evidence that Iraq was trying to buy weapons grade uranium material from the African state of Niger. I think that is one way in which we can try and hold them to account. If they won't tell us the truth, we need to find out the truth ourselves and to publish it as far and wide as we can all around the world so that they have no hiding place.
David Miller is the editor of the new book, Tell Me Lies, Propaganda and Media Distortion in the Attack on Iraq. He's a member of the Sterling Media Research Institute. The book's published by Pluto Books. You can find it online at www.plutobooks.com. David Miller, thanks so much for joining us on Regime Change Radio.
It's been a pleasure.
For Regime Change Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program was produced in the studios of listener-supported WHUS Stores, Radio for the People. If you would like further information on this program or to suggest a topic for another show, write to me at rcrradio@aol.com. The views and opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or the University of Connecticut.